your favorite source for Chicago White Sox talk, delivering news, interviews, analysis, and more. This is the Sox Machine Podcast with your hosts, Jim Margulis, James Fegan, and Josh Nelson.
Thanks, Rob, and welcome to another episode of the Sox Machine Podcast. I'm your host, Josh Nelson. It's Sunday night, May 18, 2025, as we bring you this new episode. You can check out our previous show with MLB.com's Jim Callis as we talk about the top White Sox prospects and look ahead to the 2025 Major League Baseball draft class. In starting that episode, we shared our amazement in how well Pete Crow Armstrong has been playing for the Cubs. And boy, did he dominate the White Sox this weekend. So another sweep for the Cubs over the White Sox, and now that's eight straight losses for the White Sox against the crosstown rival. Clearly, that's not good. We'll recap that series as the pitching got a little exposed. The defense got really exposed. But hey, Miguel Vargas, he was the big bright spot this weekend. The White Sox don't have an off day until Thursday, which means they are back in action on Monday as the Seattle Mariners roll into town. We'll preview that series, speculate if roster help will be on the way, and check in around Major League Baseball as the Minnesota Twins finally had their long winning streak snapped. And the Baltimore Orioles are in full panic mode as they fired their manager. Let's get started. Joining me are Sox Machine's beat reporter James Fegan and managing editor Jim Margulis. And gentlemen, hello. Not a great weekend at Wrigley Field for the White Sox, James. We were a bit concerned because we knew this was going to be a good test for the White Sox pitching, which has been overachieving based on the overall quality stuff. And as they found out this weekend, when the wind is blowing out, that's a challenge. When the defense is not playing all that great behind you, that's another challenge. But just the quality hitters the White Sox pitchers had to face this weekend. Still maybe a step behind getting the White Sox to where they want to be maybe in a few years. But at least for now, they were not able to, I guess, win this challenge against a much talented Cubs lineup.
I have it's always ill-advised to lean on overly positive for the White Sox. It's burned me time and again. 5-6 years running now. My hot take is that the pitching wasn't that bad this weekend. Burke was bad. He'll tell you as much. Shane Smith looked really good. He threw hard. He had the one inning that got away from him. You know, not that he deserves no blame for 5 unearned runs, but they were unearned runs for a reason. No one was disputing their unearned status. And I thought Cannon looked really good until his defense also betrayed him. I thought Cannon looked very good. I thought, you know, arguably Cannon looked as good as anyone. You know, Smith's stuff is obviously better, but like Cannon was executing on a level. And it would be nice if the reliever you just traded for looked good, but also you trade for a guy who was on a Triple A team for a team that is trying to contend. So if they really thought he looked great, they probably would call them up themselves. But you didn't, like, they didn't blow a lead with the bullpen. Like, yeah, I don't think many of the relievers pitched particularly well, but you didn't like turn over a lead to Cam Boozer and Jordan Leisure and they couldn't handle it. Do I have like utmost confidence they could have gotten PCA out? Maybe not. Like, no one was really doing that, so why would I imbue that upon them? But I didn't think this, I thought this game was a lot more like, yeah, there are offensive issues outside of Vargas, pretty pronounced. You're still not hearing, you know, Luis Robert obviously looked better on Sunday and you hope that's something, but it's still a weak offense, top half of the lineup at best type of situation. And you know, the whole Bond issue of regularly putting him in the middle and still kind of waiting for him to start get going. But I thought defense is really bad and cost a lot of games, and they just showed no ability to deal with the wind whatsoever. Bullpen, you obviously, they don't have a bullpen that's strong enough to keep them in games when they're behind. But I don't know if that's really new information. It just kind of got really distended in the way it went. But as far as like rotation wise, the biggest issue with the rotation is probably like how much longer do they stick with Bryce Wilson, or what do they do if any other issues pop up? And you know, there could be activity on that front, but I don't think you got like our capable back end starters are actually bad, and then we just watch them get bludgeoned. I think Burke mostly kind of beat himself in the way Burke beats himself. Mm-hmm. And I thought Cannon and Smith looked really good. So obviously not good. I did get stumped on this today by two non-Sox writers. Who is the last White Sox pitcher with a win in the Crosstown series?
Okay, this is a great question. So they've lost.
He is not in the organization, but he was homegrown, if that helps. No longer in the organization. He was homegrown.
No longer in the organization. Was homegrown.
Carlos Rodon?
That's too far back. Think 2023. They won a game
in 2023. I was thinking starter, sorry.
Lane Ramsey is the
Lane answer. Ramsey. Last White Sox pitcher to win a game against the Cubs. Oh man. Well, it's not been a good run. I think now the Cubs have the lead against the White Sox for most wins. They're now what, a one game over the White Sox in the history of the interleague. So I guess that's that.
Lane Ramsey is now pitching for Pensacola, double A for the Marlins, doing well. Just in case you were wondering, because I was.
White Sox could be wondering.
That also is his only major league win.
Nice. Okay, so maybe I was a little bit harsh. Jonathan Cannon, Shane Smith, they looked good. Jim, the defense was really bad. And this is where, like, we're going to talk about Joshua Palacios in a moment, but like Brooks Baldwin missed the play. The Cubs scored twice on the White Sox, throwing two home plates with the infield in for a Shane Smith start. Like, there's just a lot of bad defense this series, and I'm hoping that it's a hiccup. But I am a bit concerned because, obviously, this is like staying power for some of these guys who are fringe major leaguers on the White Sox. And if they can't hold up defensively, I'm not sure what the long-term future is or what their long-term standing is with the organization. They really do have staying power. What are your thoughts about the defense this weekend, Jim? Is this something that we have to be really mindful of moving forward? That is it regressing?
On one hand, it's a series, you know, you'd obviously take the, just, I guess, the long scope of it and say, yeah, it's a small sample size. They've been playing okay. It was Wrigley, high pressure situation, a lot of wind, might not be used to playing in those conditions, and pressure beget pressure, and they kind of crumbled under it, and maybe going back to a more normal environment against Seattle will be better. The flip side is that when you look at the White Sox record, just wins and losses, they've been running pretty much evenly with the 2024 White Sox. You know, they have the same record as them through 47 games, but they've had some well-timed blowouts to where, like, oh, it's nice, easy games in the ballpark. Like, they've been playing better at home, aside from early on avoiding long losing streaks. So it's felt better, but it isn't better in terms of wins and losses. So this would be the kind of series where they finally look as ugly as the record says they are. I think the outfield, you know, Brooks Baldwin in left. I really haven't understood the way the White Sox have deployed Brooks Baldwin. You know, my idea would have been play him at shortstop while Jake Amaya is there, because you don't want to see Jake Amaya there. And then, you know, as either Montgomery or Mydroth, whoever grows up, graduates, kicks him off the position, then you start expanding his defensive portfolio, see how it goes. But the White Sox, you know, and also, you know, playing him at shortstop would allow him to establish himself as a hitter and, you know, put him at the least demanding, most demanding defensive position, least demanding offensive position, and see how it goes. But instead, they've kind of thrown him into corner outfield spots where he has to hit. And so that exacerbates the lack of offensive production when he's not playing a good defensive corner outfield. And he's also not being a good offensive corner outfielder. So I really haven't understood the deal there. And I think, you know, they've done largely a good job of putting players in a position to succeed with all the changes they've made mid game, late game. But Baldwin, I think, is the one guy who's like wearing it in terms of just somebody they feel like they can throw out anywhere and are willing to accept the flaws. So there's, you know, I think that's really the biggest issue is, you know, in terms of defensive talent, I think that's one of the big ones. And so as you see outfielders come back, Austin Slater, Mike Tauchman, Andrew Benintendi won't, you know, he's not going to improve the defense out there, but he won't. He'll give more DH spots to where it's going to crowd a guy like Baldwin out. I think you could finally see the outfield look like it was supposed to all along. So that's something that could make this more of an aberration. But it is a whole bunch of players who are either trying to get established or on their last legs or are trying to define themselves as a bench player for a good team while playing more than they should for a bad team. And so I think that's the kind of thing that can lead to cascade failures like we saw this weekend.
The idea of Brooks Baldwin at shortstop, we've seen a lot of Chase Mydroth, and this does surprise me. When you look at run value fielding wise on Baseball Savant, Baseball Savant likes Mydroth at shortstop. Overall, so far this year, Mydroth's been worth 2 runs above average. His OAA on Baseball Savant at shortstop is 3.
Yeah, he's been fine.
Which is, yeah, he's positive. And it likes Mydroth's range. Range-wise, he ranks the 90th percentile for fielding in Major League Baseball. Doesn't like his arm strength. Doesn't have a very strong arm. Averages 80.5 miles per hour on throws. That's in the 30th percentile. But he's able to get to the ball right now as far as his athleticism. Because that when you mentioned Brooks Baldwin playing a shortstop, it's like, hold on, I haven't really checked in to see if Mydroth, at least data-wise, is doing well at shortstop. The eye test, James, tells me no, Mydroth is not a shortstop. This is a fun little experiment the White Sox are running. His best spot would be second base moving forward until the White Sox find a shortstop. But I guess Mydroth has been playing better there than I was expecting.
I talked to Justin Jersey about this just this morning before other people had more active discussions with Justin Jersey over the course of the day. but yeah, he touted like Mydroth being big into their, emphasis on pre-pitch movement and putting himself in a lot of good angles and, being really low to the ground and all sorts of little details that get around not having like the sort of like physical tools that make you think he'd be a shortstop, which Baldwin has. Like Baldwin's like sneakily really high in sprint speed, in addition to just being kind of like more lanky, rangy athlete you think of down there. But yeah, I feel like he's putting together fine. It's hard to convince anyone of a plus defender when there's such a prominent clip of a pop-up hitting off his head, but I think he's hold it down.
That was at second base. Shortstop.
Right, at the second base. He's out of his natural home. That is the real issue. It seems weird that it's weird the way they've handled it. Now, obviously, Rojas is back, and that's probably who they always envisioned. Only on second base. Obviously, they've been giving Lenin Sosa a lot of run, which is the dedicated sect of people that I occasionally associate myself with who are in favor of that. And I think he's still leading the team in hits, so you can't really say it's been a lost effort. But I agree. Like, if such a benefit was seen from starting Brooks Baldwin as an everyday shortstop in AA, last year, even now that Mydroth's here and it makes it a little bit moot, they did not have a really established shortstop. They had Jacob Maya, whose defensive gifts were clear, but quite predictably wound up being someone they DFA'd by mid-May. It was never really a long-term solution. Why was that not something they were willing to give quarter to? I understand, of course, that 3 outfielders on the IL, and that's given way to even weirder permutations or corner outfield mainstays in Baldwin that I think are lower down the agenda. But yeah, they've even with just Jacob Gonzalez getting promoted last year, who's now since moved over to second base for William Bergoya, that's been enough to like move Brooks into the super utility role that they've carved out for him. And it's not unrealistic of what he could be. It's makes sense. It's kind of what he was in college. And from what he talked up, how much he played outfield in college, it's a little disappointing how he struggled out there, but also understandable. He just hasn't done it that much as a pro. I think it reminds me of like a lesser version of, Grant Taylor pitching the bullpen this early. Like, yeah, that's probably where he's going to end up. That's the more likely outcome. You usually see teams kind of, or especially like the last front office, they did it to a fault, chasing like the maximal outcome until like the bitter end, until you sacrifice the old day idea of like, we're going to let him play shortstop until he proves he can't type of mentality. It's been interesting to see them not do that with instances this year with certain guys where, maybe it's a a waste of time or just kind of a sake of exercise, but it feels like when you view Brooks in a vacuum, it seems like moving around has not done him well, and it's probably set him up to be, with what the role he's been playing, where he's just kind of a below average left fielder, as you're about to like bring a bunch of guys back off the IL. It probably makes sense to option him right now. It's like he's not getting infield starts. He's not hitting. He's been one of the worst hitters in the league in May, and he's not defending well. So I don't know if it's like the biggest tragedy on the roster situation, but it feels accusatory to say Brooks was set up to fail. I don't think they set him up to fail, but he was put in a very difficult position to succeed, where you'd be super impressed by his mettle if he pulled it off. And now it feels like, well, what could I have done better now that he hasn't really pulled it off, and it's probably going to go look really good in Charlotte for a little bit.
The impact, like I feel, it feels like in the scheme of things, it's like it may be a 3 out of 10 in terms of like how much this is hurting the team. But in terms of like individual questions about why they've handled it the way they do and like how confusing it is, especially with Jake Amaya there getting more playing time, way more playing time at shortstop, that feels like an 8 out of 10. So I think it's easy to overemphasize the 8 out of 10 part when we're talking about a guy who might not be a major leaguer anyway. It was there have been a lot of selling points to the first couple months of the Will Venable administration, but I think this is one of the pieces I put in the minus column.
Well, he's got another one. I'll get to that in a moment. The bright spot this weekend for the White Sox, Miguel Vargas. This weekend against the Cubs, 6 for 10, a double, 3 home runs, 5 RBIs. And a reminder, on April 19th, Vargas was hitting 139 with a 235 on base percentage and slugging just 194. Like, an awful start. An awful start for Miguel Vargas. In his last 30 games, he's batting 284 with a 352 on base percentage and slugging 514. Vargas keeps that up. He's going to challenge Shane Smith to be the All-Star representative for the White Sox. That's amazing. I don't remember the last White Sox third baseman that had an 866 OPS. Maybe Yoan Moncada back in the super bouncy ball time in 2019. But the month of May, Vargas is batting 296 this month with a 371 on base percentage and slugging 648. It's an OPS over 1,000 in the month of May for Vargas with those 5 home runs and 12 RBIs, and he leads the White Sox with 6 home runs. Jim, is it just too easy to boil it down and say it is all about the hand adjustment for Miguel Vargas? Because every time Vargas has a big play, like John Schriffen and the broadcast for Chicago Sports Network will say, that's the hand adjustment, man. And, keep pounding the table that it's all the changes that he made in Minneapolis. He's unlocked the final version. And this is what the White Sox were dreaming on when they acquired Miguel Vargas last year.
A couple of hand position tweaks that have, it's been a circuitous route, but I don't know if any step along the way could be skipped. Like, I don't know. I'm doubtful that, like, if he just changes hand position to what he's doing now last year, that, he would have been better last year. It probably took a little bit of a journey to get him where he's at. So, yeah, I think it's, I was curious, your comment about him making the All-Star team, and I had the same thought in terms of, like, who's there. Among third basemen, Alex Bregman looks like an easy all-star the way he's playing right now. But behind him, it's a little bit open. Like, not a whole lot of name brand talent. Jose Ramirez is there. And he'll probably be there, but they need another infielder along those lines. Like, number three in the American League, you're talking about Isak Paredes, Michael Garcia, Zach McKinstry is playing really well, but like nobody, these are all kind of, I would say Paredes, has had a couple of years, but otherwise they're kind of in the same Vargas tier in terms of being names that are known, but not necessarily known for great baseball. So should there be an injury or should something open up to where like all of a sudden they need like a third baseman on the American League All-Star team, it is open for them.
Is there any additional insight, James, on Vargas, especially like this weekend? I mean, he took advantage of the wind, which bravo, at least somebody did in this White Sox team. Ball in air, please hit the ball in left field, and he certainly took advantage of it. But there's a difference between, hey, Vargas is finding a groove to, oh my gosh, Vargas has got an OPS over 1,000 in the month of May. Like, this is tremendous production that the White Sox has sorely needed. Is there anything other than just the hand adjustment? Anything else that he's been working on? Is there like a particular pitch that he's focused on to take advantage of when he sees it?
I mean, the hand adjustment was like specifically targeted towards four seamers that his path used to like kind of cut under them, and starting him up a little bit higher allowed him to kind of be more direct to them. And so thus he could kind of fend it off in a way that he hadn't been able to. I think a question for him, like when I have more time to talk to him, would be like, so how is your path on low pitches now? Because you definitely have seen him, you know, one, hit some high four seamers out, but also just like whack high breaking balls. And look, high breaking balls are meant to be whacked. It's really good that he's whacking them. I'm just, you know, kind of curious more about how the evolution is. And obviously we're kind of at the crest of what's probably a heater. And at some point, not that he's opened himself up in some obvious way, but there'll be a counter adjustment a little bit to the league as burn him upstairs gets taken away as a good idea. He was also like, I think a lot stems from his body. He's a lot bigger. You know, you look at his arms, are, I don't want to say they're quite like Jose Abreu biceps, but like meaningfully thicker than they were last year. And I think some of the swing moves that he was doing last year was about lack of strength. There's a lot of like winding up and extra loading with his hands that tend to just be symptoms of like, I got to put something extra to really swing the bat fast. And that was making him hard for him to time up feeders just because like the extra movement, just a bigger operation. So Jim is like right on in the sense of like, you couldn't say like, hey, move your hands up to Vargas in, you know, as he's has wasting disease or whatever, why he was losing so much weight in September, and it'd be like super useful. Cause he was, the symptoms of a swing were a response to where his body was. And now the things that you can play around with a swing are response to what his added strength is allowing him to do. Still looks like a pretty big dude. I think we were kind of worried, like, how much would he maintain this weight? I don't know if like mid-May is really the crucible where you see that. You think more of the hot months and the second half of the season, but it's good that the power has not been like a first couple weeks. And then literally once the grind of the schedule starts, like it's wasting away from him a little bit. So I think the strength and where his body is kind of enables the swing adjustment to click. So that's kind of the thing to keep watching. Like, does any of that slip over the course of the year where you need something more, or he can't be as short to the ball as his current setup has him doing and still delivering impact? So, in one sense, yes, it is all the swing adjustment as far as like clicking, but in the other sense, like there's so many things he had to put in place for that to be a difference maker.
Yeah. Just to the point, like four seamers, because when you're breaking down your points, James, looking at Miguel Vargas's Baseball Savant page, he already has more base hits against four seamers from right-handed pitchers than he did all in the month of April. Vargas only had four base hits in April against a right-hander's four-seam fastball. That could explain a lot, but he's already got five hits. He's already got a couple home runs against the four-seamer. So maybe that is something to draw attention to, especially when he's facing righties, and he'll face some tough righties in this upcoming series against Seattle. Can Vargas keep this momentum?
I was basically trying to verbalize the image of my mind, which was Ryan Fuller miming out a four-seamer and his swing
pack. Okay.
And what he did. And I don't know how much the Sox are paying Ryan, but like if we could get him to be like a, you know how they have like the ASL communicator on the side, if we could just give him like mime out swing pass on the side of the video, like while we're talking about any player, I feel like it'd be instructive to our listeners.
I think so too.
Or viewers more than our listeners.
Ryan Fuller, if you're listening and watching this, if you would like to participate, let us know. We'll send you an email. You can join us on the Zoom, and we can add you as another square into the video recording. But Miguel Vargas, keep it up. He's been fantastic for the White Sox as of late. Joshua Palacios, I don't understand the fascination. And on Sunday, he batted third against the Chicago Cubs in DH. This was the explanation from White Sox manager Will Venable and why he put Palacios at that spot in the lineup.
Who we have in there today, it makes sense. Objectively, he always pops in our top four or five against right-handed batters. So, he's continue to take it at bats, hits the ball hard. And so with how we have it structured, it made sense.
Will, I would disagree that it made sense to put Palacios batting third in the lineup. And man, Joshua Palacios, James, is getting a lot of run. A lot of run with the White Sox. More than I was ever expecting. I didn't even know that he was part of the organization, even part of the plans for 2025. But man, he's getting a lot of playing time. And he is now batting 195 with a 303 on base percentage and slugging 260. That's a 563 OPS, folks. I know the White Sox don't have a lot of options to be batting in the middle of the order, as Palacios went 1-for-9 against the Chicago Cubs. I don't want to drill too much into batting third in a Sunday lineup, but this is a lot of Joshua Palacios, James. Does this get adjusted when guys get healthy like Talkman, Slater, Benintendi, or should we just be prepared to see more Palacios going to June and July?
No. I don't think his presence on the roster survives adding two left-handed corner guys back into the on the roster in a matter of, you know, week and a half. Benintendi starting his rehab assignment, Talkman probably finishing pretty soon, if not Monday. They didn't have Talkman in the lineup of the Knights on Sunday, but Venable also acknowledged like he's 0 for 17 with nine a lot of strikeouts over his last four games. Maybe he needs a little bit more time, so we'll see. But I think that's those two injuries are pretty transparently the reason. Will's been a bit more overzealous with his use, but I think it's like, I need a left-handed outfielder. I need to balance my lineup. What's my tool? And just reaching in the closet and bringing out what it's got and throwing it in there. He's been a bit, obviously there's struggles up and down the lineup. Maybe Palacios doesn't stand out as much as others to him. I also think he's a little bit of, I think previous kind of quad A guys the White Sox have put out have been more in the mold of like one big strength on three glaring weaknesses and like trying to mitigate them. And Palacios is kind of like just kind of an all around triple A talent type of guy. Like he had bad defensive moments this weekend with the win, but like he's not a horrible defender. Like, stretched out there physically range wise. I'm mostly visualizing a lot of like Daniel Palkin, right? So Palkin, like, you know, obviously provided like offensive impact, but like Palacios is not like a slap hitter who can't hit for any power ever. He's not, you know, his OBP is over 300 despite the batting average. Like he grinds in at bat, which I think is like the one like catnip for managers is just like you have competitive at bats all the time. Even if the results don't go well, they think you're like you're executing the plan and they tend to gravitate towards that. He doesn't have like these glaring deficiencies. He just doesn't have like a reliable strength that he can deliver on. So seemingly he looks like a half decent solution to every problem that Will Venable is throwing him at. He's just not providing impact or actually succeeding very well. He's like consistently competing. He's not having like throw him the same pitch he can't handle three times in a row and then watch him walk back type of at bats. He's not like cartoonishly slow or inept on the bases. He does everything like okay. Just it's a lot of like 40 grade tools all over the place. So I get why he fits in solution, but I would say I'm more curious if you gave me the choice of asking Chris Getz or Will Venable why Palacios is playing too much. I would gravitate towards the first one because one, like this wasn't a guy who was in camp. So when did this become like your kind of option you would go to if there were injuries? I get like if it's a temporary situation and you've already taken Dominic Fletcher off the roster, maybe, and Palacios is out of options. This tenure of him playing regularly probably ends with the DFA because there's literally just no other thing to do. And maybe they don't want to do that with Fletcher, but they've already done it once. They've so aggressively walled off Dominic Fletcher from like having any role in this roster with one having five guys on guaranteed contracts and then picking up a guy who was on a free agent and signing him and playing him. Now Fletcher's not really much younger than Palacios. I think you could make the argument like what's realistically like the big future for Fletcher on the team long-term as well. But just curious to see this guy who's like playing decently well in AAA, you know, certainly would be, I don't think anyone would bat an eye. I'm like, hey, he's having success. Give him another try. We have a window of playing time with him. If they call him up, I just maybe they see the second half is more of a chance to play him again, or maybe they're just not about really giving him an extended run again, which I would be like, why is this such a kind of fervent like position on him to the point of let's play Josh Palacios all the time over him? Because
yeah,
I think his performance earned it. And on the one hand, like when a front office trades for a player and just like, because we prioritize him and acquire him, we're just going to stick with him to the bitter end, let him fail like 6-7 times over. Like, that's not great either. But it does seem curious. Like, this was someone who was like kind of intentionally acquired and given like a starting job, that they're not really kind of even looking for it for spot opportunities either. It's kind of more the thing I think with Palacios, right or wrong. When I watch a play, maybe that's biased because I interviewed like Jason Bourgeois a lot about, you know, their pre-pitch movements and all this stuff they're doing defensively and leads. And for someone, obviously, like the coaches have their different roles, and like Bourgeois' like roles is like almost exclusively focused on footwork, both offensively and defensively. But because his what his responsibilities and what his focus on is so narrow, he's like, Dominic Fletcher is like his perfect student. Like, the idea that like they're not playing this dude who kind of like so embodies what they want to do defensively and like with, you know, on the base pass is interesting. It's mostly what I think with Palacios, which is, again, it's kind of like Brooks Baldwin. Like, what they do with Dominic Fletcher is not, you know, really reflective of what the long-term organizational future is, or you know, even that speaking that much to like what player types they value. But it's the sort of thing that just makes me curious about, like, huh, I wonder why they did it that way, given that there's not really a success here to hang your hat on.
I can't argue with any of those points. You raise a good point, James, regarding Dominic Fletcher. And I don't know, we'll see when Talkman does join the White Sox for the season. Talkman is 3-for-30 against AAA pitching. Hopefully that's not the case when he faces Major League pitching.
He's a monster against Major League pitching.
Yeah, he's a monster. Hopefully he joins the lineup soon. And then the final note on the White Sox, Luis Robert, 2-for-12 in this series, 43 games played, 591 OPS. Andrew Vaughn had some moments, 1-for-10, 45 games into the season. His OPS is 530.
I will say Robert though, 4 at bats, 5 pitches seen. So if he is somebody who is a lot better when he's aggressive, he's trying that path.
Goodbye, Walker.
Venable was saying, like, he's too calculated up there. We need him to let it loose. And then there he went. Like, I'll show you.
Yeah, double.
The biggest story, though, this weekend, and one that's going to garner a lot of attention, even national attention, I think, as well, is Pico Armstrong. Against the White Sox this weekend, Pico Armstrong was 10-for-14, a double, 2 triples, a home run, 8 RBIs. He scored 4 times and he has stolen base. Before Sunday's game, Pico Armstrong, according to Fangraphs, is worth 2.8 WAR. That's going to exceed probably a couple combined White Sox position players in total WAR total in 2025. But what's remarkable is that PCA leads the National League in WAR right now. If you had MVP voting right now in the National League, you're looking at PCA, Corbin Carroll, and Shohei Ohtani. And Jim, like, even talking like Jim Callis in the previous episode, it surprised me. It shocked Jim. Like, we never thought that he could be this type of offensive player when he was in high school and try to forecast what kind of major leaguer he would be before being selected in late in the first round by the New York Mets. And then, of course, he's part of the Javi Baez trade to the Chicago Cubs. But PCA could be a monster. And, like, for the White Sox searching for solutions, it's like, oh, man, PCA would be great for the White Sox. There you go. That's your answer when you trade Luis Robert. But, yeah, the Cubs may have someone pretty special in Pico Armstrong.
Yeah, he was one of the players I wanted to see this weekend. You know, watching the Cubs more on paper, more on their baseball reference page, and seeing like, wow, this lineup is running at least 7 deep most games. And even like Nico Horner struggling, like, he's a major leaguer. So like, if he's batting 8th for you, you're not in trouble. But really hadn't seen much of him. Seen the highlights, especially in the field, but hadn't really seen him at the plate. And yeah, I mean, yeah, we've seen Byron Buxton in the AL Central, and he seems like the kind of counterpoint in the NL in terms of plate approach. Seems like you should be able to beat him with lefty, but oftentimes you don't. And when you don't, it really blows up on you. And then the fact that he can change games in the field as well on the base paths makes you look silly, like just taking extra bases, which Buxton does when his legs are healthy. Yeah, that's kind of what came to mind for me. And thinking about that trade,
I like that comp. I just hope that Armstrong doesn't have the injury history, right?
Yeah, and I was listening to the your interview with Jim, and I recommend it for people mowing the lawn. That's how I listened to it. It perfectly took up the amount of time I needed while working outside. Listening to him talk about the Mets side of the trade, the Javi Baez trade, and saying like it was the worst trade they made, and like he barely played due to a shoulder injury, I think it was. And why'd they give up on him for Javi Baez? And yeah, it kind of reminded me a little bit of like the Edgar Caro trade, of just taking advantage of front office that's kind of sweaty and maybe not having a prospect who's in a position to succeed. You know, and PCA's case was injury. Caro's case, it was like a really aggressive promotion to double A. But either way, like, players are not in a position to impress, and the Cubs were able to spin that into a big victory. And, you know, the White Sox really seem to be doing well with the Edgar Caro trade. So, you know, as we go along with the, you know, towards the trade deadline, you know, Luis Robert, you know, we've been, that's been a regular conversation in terms of what he can bring back, you know, for as much disappointment as his season has generated so far. I think like the Javi Baez trade is a good example of, or even like the Lucas Giolito trade, being a case where sometimes you don't have to trade a guy at the peak of his value to get a guy who can be the part of the next great team. If you just happen to, be in a position to appreciate, somebody who another organization has soured on. So, keep that in mind as we go through the various permutations of what could be a diminished Luis Robert trade package.
No, great point, Jim. Great point. And the Chicago White Sox, they stay in Chicago, but they'll be playing at home. They'll be in the South Side again this week as two American League West opponents visit the White Sox and the Seattle Mariners and the Texas Rangers. The first series is Seattle. The Mariners are 26-19 this year. They're first place in the American League West. They have a 2.5 game lead over Houston and Texas. The Mariners have won their last three games. They are 5-5 in their last 10. On the road, they've been pretty good. They are 13-8 away from Seattle. Offensively, when you look at team OPS, the Mariners rank 10th in Major League Baseball with a team OPS of 728. They're 6th in Major League Baseball in total home runs hit with 62, and they're 8th in Major League Baseball in stolen bases. The eye-opening stat is their home and away splits. On the road this year, Seattle has a team OPS of 782. That is good for third in Major League Baseball. They've hit 32 homers on the road, and they've stolen 24 bases on the road as well, so about half. But they are way better at contact, and they are way better about getting on base on the road than at home. So that's going to be a challenge for the White Sox if these trends continue for Seattle. Your pitching probables. Monday night, 6:40 p.m. Central Time. Luis Castillo for the Seattle Mariners will be going up against the dart, Davis Martin. Tuesday, 6:40 p.m. Central Time. It's to be announced for Seattle. Right now, it's Bryce Wilson for the White Sox. We'll chat about that part, the right now, in a moment. Wednesday afternoon, 1:10 p.m. Central Time. Logan Evans for Seattle against Shane Smith. For those planning to go to these games, prepare yourselves to be Reinsdorfed. 79% chance of rain on Tuesday, 71% chance of rain on Wednesday. So keep an eye on the forecast and the weather before entering the gates at Wright Field. James,
deal with it. I didn't know about this.
All right, so... could the White Sox be getting some help? There's some gossip that they could be adding another pitcher to the rotation. We've been working to, I guess, finalize or get someone to admit from the White Sox that this move is happening. But it seems with Miguel Castro being added to the bullpen for the White Sox, on Monday, James, are you anticipating more roster changes for the White Sox?
I mean, certainly in terms of like injuries, like with Slater and Tauchman not playing on Sunday, that would signal like they were kind of supposed to be there for a week. Venable kind of talked about like Tauchman not maybe being right and maybe need like timing wise, not physically, you know, based on his performance. At the same time, their actions kind of indicated such. Corey Lee did play on Sunday, and every indication was like Corey Lee's probably going to be the odd man out unless something happens. And I think even if like Matt Tice is like playing competently enough, that I think some team will need a catcher and ask about him, or maybe kind of already doing some background work on him from what I hear. But I would be shocked if that happened in May. And Corey Lee is an option, which the White Sox have mentioned a few times. So I think it's a more logical thing to expect. But yeah, like Tauchman and Slater are kind of like any day they could be called back. And, you know, that changes the outfield picture significantly. I'd be surprised if they are not giving like Elko some level of run to really prove it. Like even if three bats in the lineup, you know, you could see him as the odd man out. But Benintendi's starting a rehab assignment, so there was a little bit like push and pull about whether he would just be straight activated and that would be a bigger crunch for them to kind of import. But if he's going on rehab, that at least probably pushes that to the weekend series, if not next week at the latest. And, you know, we've heard some gossip about possibly trying to add another arm to the rotation.
Yeah.
Bryce Wilson certainly hasn't been good in the rotation and sounded pretty frustrated in Cincinnati about the way things were going. You don't want to hear we have to go back to the drawing board after a start in any context. And, you know, peripherals weren't great, but he was an effective right-handed reliever, and they're clearly strapped for that right now to the point where they acquired Miguel Castro. So shifting him back to that, you know, they think highly of him as a person and, you know, his versatility. So I don't think they'd – and frankly, anyone that they deigned to give a guaranteed contract to this offseason, I expect to be pried out of their hands. So I don't think he'd be giving up on him at any point, but they could shift him back to what he was doing before. They're going to need started up of some kind. They're going to sign some starters at some point, because if you think about any of their options, they're all either hurt or not in a position to do it. Nastrini and Wickham and Gonzalez are already in the bullpen. Jairo Uriarte is essentially in the developmental list. With his... You know, they kind of listed Wickelman's like option situation where he's already in second option year for why they kind of cut bait to put in a bullpen. Jairo Uriarte is in the exact same boat. And then Thorpe is hurt. Adams is hurt. Kai Bush is hurt. Juan Corella is hurt. Probably someone else I'm forgetting about, TJ. Sorry. I'm sure it's...
Hope Jesse Schultens is almost back.
Jesse Schultens is almost back. Yeah. I think you'd probably... I don't think you'd see that alone and be like, well, we're all good for depth.
Yeah.
So
just think about names and Tommy John surgeries.
This is also a time of year where if you are a veteran starter in AAA and you're doing pretty well and not getting called up, you have an opt out to kind of activate and say like, hey, I'm going to ask for free agency and see if there's anyone willing to give me some major league starts. And if not, maybe I'll come back. I think you see a lot of players in that situation, so I would expect them to be scouring in that regard, because they just don't have anything that's really worth giving a long-term opportunity to. As a callback to spring training, though, I was previewing the series, Josh Rojas said that it's the batter's eye at T-Mobile in Seattle affects right-handed hitters, but not left-handed hitters in his experience. That he's never an issue for it. And I think the splits back him up on that. So it's probably the right-handed Mariners hitters who are going to see like be significantly better. I can think of one center fielder of considerable talent who might be more of a monster without a batter's eye. At the same time, the White Sox are better against right-handers. All their starters, basic question is how can they handle lefties, which is what I found particularly impressive about what Kane is able to do on Sunday. But I think that's my third tangent of the original answer. Back to you, Josh.
Well, two things I'll add is, one, I was thinking about the T-Mobile thing, and yeah, it's, you know, those splits are bearing out right now. Rodriguez is running a 678 OPS at home, 769 on the road. So he's one of those players who, you know, kind of embodies the big difference. The other thing I was thinking about is thinking about all these pitching staff permutations and thinking, it's incredible for reasons positive and negative, that the White Sox pitching staff has two Rule 5 picks and neither of them are the problem. Like, neither of them are causing the compromises of like, oh, we got to be carrying this guy. So yeah, it's not like the Dylan Covey situation where, you know, other pitchers might be better, but if they can just gut through it, they can option them down the next year. Like, they've, you know, Mike Vassell's been fine. Shane Smith has been awesome. You know, they're both holding up the jobs of more established people. And so I guess kudos to them and the white, you could say kudos to them and the White Sox player evaluation system, except the White Sox player evaluation system is responsible for the other parts of the White Sox pitching staff that, you know, aren't working. So it's a funny game.
It is a funny game. Tough right-handed pitching for the White Sox this week. We'll see how they fare against Castillo.
tough right-handed pitching, which means Joshua Palacios. Like, just get ready for that.
Yep. Brace thyself. Well, we'll see. Maybe a Monday we'll get our blessing, Jim. Talkman replaces Palacios.
With the way Miguel Vargas is hitting four seamers, I don't think Luis Castillo can throw 51 fastballs in a row again, or whatever it was. Yeah, try that again, buddy.
Yeah, and again, the weather. Just keep an eye on the weather. 79% chance of rain on Tuesday. Better than 70% chance on Wednesday. I don't know about you guys. My yard could use it, but the White Sox have an off day on Thursday. If it really wanted to rain, just let it rain all day on Thursday. But that's not how the weather works. We'll recap this series later this week in an upcoming podcast. But now we switch it over to around Major League Baseball. Two big stories, especially out of the American League, in my opinion. One, the Minnesota Twins not that long ago were 13-20. And I thought, yep, they're done. This is not working. This is a season of hell for them. Welcome to the bottom of the American League Central. Then they snapped together a 13-game winning streak. They lost on Sunday. But the Minnesota Twins are suddenly in second place. They're 26-21 now. Really turn their season around. They're still five games back at Detroit. Detroit's got the best record in the American League right now. They're 31-16. But the Twins have caught up with the Guardians and the Royals. So you have this little fun four-team race right now. A really strong three-team race for second place behind the Tigers in the division. But the Baltimore Orioles firing their manager, Brandon Hyde, who not long ago won Manager of the Year. Baltimore has lost six straight games. They have a negative 85 run differential. The White Sox run differential is negative 53. They're 15-30. The White Sox are 14-33. The fact that I have to associate the Baltimore Orioles, Jim, with the Chicago White Sox, and I can say this without everyone laughing at me in the same sentence in 2025, really displays the, I don't even know what's the correct word, just the absolute chaos in a most negative way for Baltimore at this stage. And after firing the manager, if this doesn't turn around, I don't know if Rick Hahn wants another front office job, but I think there's going to be a front office opening because I don't understand if this doesn't get better for Baltimore, how you keep anyone, both in the front office and in the coaching staff. It seems like they need to hit the reset button.
Yeah, I mean, Hyde was an obvious fall guy. It's the easiest move to make when it comes to just like an in-season shakeup. But this was, you know, maybe not seen to this extent, you know, being last in the AL East. But preseason, you know, all the talk was about, are the Orioles going to add a pitcher? I mean, we've been on that the other end of, will the Orioles add a pitcher when Dylan Cease was on the trade block forever? And he made all the sense in the world given their position prospect overflow and given their obvious rotation needs, like why is Dylan Cease not in Baltimore? And then they got Corbin Burns and then like they didn't have an interest in retaining him, even though it seemed like Corbin Burns was exactly what the Orioles needed. And they did not pursue that. Instead, you know, it's Charlie Morton, who's 41. And then you have Kyle Gibson, who, you know, is fine, you know, MIZ, you know, I'm a Kyle Gibson fan for that reason, but like in terms of just, he's always just somebody and, you know, filling out a rotation, fine. But in terms of like somebody who can come in and give the rotation a boost, help overcome, injuries to better pitchers, absences of like Kyle Bradish. Can you pick up a rotation when Kyle Bradish is out? No, you can't do that with a Kyle Gibson or a Charlie Morton. So this is, an obvious pain point, and it really seems like they are paying the price for hubris. And I mean, from a White Sox perspective, that's what we saw with the White Sox. Like, sure, you're not going to augment this roster any further. Sure, you're not going to alleviate that, the injury prone problem, or the greater number of DHs than actual outfielders you have. Like, sure, you're not going to do anything about that. And they didn't, and it all collapsed. And it's kind of similar here with Baltimore in terms of having one obvious flaw and not really paying any heed to it in a meaningful way, especially after, Burns left. And now their offense is, more or less ordinary. I'd be curious what like Ryan Fuller's thoughts are, speaking of getting him on the show, in terms of he was kind of treated as the fall guy last year. Well, both hitting coaches were. And I'm curious whether they're looking at it kind of just watching the ship sink and being like, oh, glad we got off it. Might be working for the worst team in the American League, but at least I'm not directly responsible for the major league product anymore, and can go about roving and helping individual players at lower levels versus just having to be the, well, they were the first fall guys, and now Hyde is the second fall guy.
Yeah, just it's a fascinating story. And right now, if the season were to end today, the Colorado Rockies don't qualify to have a top pick in the 2026 draft. The best that they're going to be able to do is 10th overall next year. The Pirates, the White Sox, and the Orioles would have the highest odds of earning the number one pick in the MLB draft lottery. That's how bad it has gotten for Baltimore. They're going to go from buyers to sellers real fast. Cedric Mullins suddenly is competition in the Luis Robert market for center fielders with the upcoming trade deadline, as Mullins will be a free agent after the 2025 season. James, how about you? What's catching your attention around Major League Baseball?
Well, first, the Rockies' pursuit of infamy is captivating. They're on pace. They're still the worst road hitting team in the league. They have a 61 WRC plus entering Sunday, and they got shut out, so probably didn't improve upon it very much. But they were down 5 runs in the sixth inning on Saturday and came back and beat the Diamondbacks 14-12 in Arizona. Ezekiel Tovar, who had a 550 OPS coming into that game, had 5 hits. You're talking about like memories I have of last season and how awful it is, just the random triumphs like that make you wonder like where the hell this came from. But the Rockies scoring 14 runs on 19 hits on the road, while like otherwise like threatening records about like the worst road futility offensively in history. They had Germán Márquez got chased out of like 3 innings with 8 runs allowed in this game, and they won. Absurdity. They're still 8-38 after very, very another reminiscence of 24 White Sox come out and get shut out on 3 hits the next day after that. Very fitting. But I should have mentioned this, when I was marooned in Cincinnati, but they were coming off getting blown out in the last game. But we were watching a post game interview with Will Benson after the Reds beat the White Sox in the finale of that series, and he said, in fitting with what we say about the one White Sox win series, they had a team meeting after the first 2 games, losing that series to the White Sox. It was Pete Rose night the second game. Obviously, the park was full. So maybe not as dramatically booed off the field the way the Cardinals were last year in the first road series the White Sox won, but repeated, like, there was more like, there wasn't like one big effort when they lost. There was a big booing. It was like they kept going, innings kept ending in unsavorable fashion, and the Reds fans were just letting them have it repeatedly. Like, how is this happening over and over again? Obviously, bigger crowd, a lot of people, a lot more casuals probably in the stands. Given the ceremony, but it seemed very aligned with like the White Sox being the team that kind of forces team meetings upon people. Or to put it, in more in theme of recent events, getting defeated by the Pope's team was a come to Jesus moment for the Cincinnati
Ah,
Reds.
there we go.
Now that that disgusting wordplay is over with, I'll turn it over to Jim.
How about you, Jim? What's catching your attention around baseball?
Yeah, aside from the Twins, you know, almost not losing between podcast episodes and needing a Jackson Churio home run robbery to deny him on Sunday of, you know, well, that would have tied the game, but still, like, just, you know, I guess we've seen the Buxton do that to the White Sox, and they had that done to them by Jackson Churio. You know, aside from that one, which we talked about, like, have you seen the season that Trent Grisham's having?
No.
With the Yankees?
No.
He's slugging 607. He's got 12 homers. He's playing center field. Like, it reminds me of the, you know, Yankees of, well, I should say not your, but like, you know, speaking of Mike Talkman, just like they would get random seasons out of random journeymen or fourth outfielders who suddenly became first outfielders, or like 10 great starts from somebody else's fifth starter to move him over the top. Like Gio Urshela was another guy who like reinvented himself, you know, with the Yankees, and just, you know, he seems like that guy right now. And it's really unfair, like in terms of like what the Yankees offense looks like. You know, they just had a big loss with Oswaldo Cabrera, horrible injury at home plate, like kind of like Robin Ventura grade ankle injury at home plate. But otherwise, when you look at like their, and we talked about this last time with the Cubs lineup and how stable it is, like the Yankees lineup is incredibly stable. And one of the reasons it's stable is because like Trent Grisham is almost has 1,000 OPS. And how, you know, like why, yeah, where have those been like for the White Sox? So like the last thing the Yankees need is Trent. And also, like, if you look at, you know, when you watch highlights of Trent Grisham, he's got like the, even though the Yankees changed their facial hair policy, he still has a mustache. Like he looks like Willie Randolph, or he looks like he could be somebody like off, you know, 1984 Yankees team photo. Yeah. So I like that as well. Like he's got the, between the hair and the mustache, like he's got the look of a guy who should be a Yankee all along. And, and then he's next to Aaron Judge, who is, redefining what a player can do.
Yeah. Judge still batting 401. Grisham, 12 home runs, one double, one triple. Love it. I just love it. What a stat line. I'm glad you brought that up, Jim. Oh, good stuff. Good stuff. Well, that will do it for this episode of the Sox Machine Podcast. We'll have more coverage of the Seattle series that you can check online at SoxMachine.com. If there's anything that you missed over the weekend, if you got busy, if you want more details of what's going on with Grant Taylor and some of the White Sox prospects and roster decision-making, James wrote a great piece over the weekend from the scrum that Chris Getz, the White Sox general manager, had prior to the Cubs series. Again, another podcast episode, the previous one with Jim Callis. You can get his thoughts on the White Sox top prospects, the upcoming MLB draft. Speaking of the MLB draft, we'll have the Sox Machine updated top 100 prospects as college baseball now enters into the conference tournament play this week. And next week will be NCAA regionals, really ramping up to the College World Series. Then it'll be the draft combine. And then we'll finally get into the draft. So within 2 months of the MLB draft happening, another opportunity for the White Sox to add more prospects. And we'll see what the upcoming roster moves are going to be. So activity for the White Sox is going to be picking up pretty soon here, other than just the games on the field. And of course, check out all the news on SoxMachine.com. But if you just discovered the Sox Machine podcast, you can subscribe to the show wherever you listen to podcasts, such as Spotify and Apple Music. You can listen and watch our videos on our YouTube channel at youtube.com/SoxMachine. Follow us on social media. We're on all the platforms at Sox Machine. You'll definitely want to follow James, especially for the Tuesday and Wednesday games when he's bored out of his mind sitting in the press box watching another rain delay. And to get those updates on when are the White Sox going to play, you can follow him at JR Fegan. You can follow me at SoxMachine_Josh. If you enjoy our work and want full access to all of our coverage of the Chicago White Sox and Major League Baseball and our coverage of the draft, sign up at SoxMachine.com to be a subscriber. $5 a month gets you an ad-free version of both the podcast and the website, full access to all of our coverage, and access to the comments section as well. We have additional tiers of support. Maybe you were listening to the gossip that we've been hearing about the White Sox maybe making some trades or teams inquiring about certain players. Well, if you want to hear and read that type of gossip, you can join our Veterans Committee. which gets you direct access to both Jim and James and be part of our group chat. You can sign up at SoxMachine.com. The Sox Machine Podcast is a production of SoxMachine.com, your home for all things Chicago White Sox baseball and part of the Blue Wire Podcast Network. Alongside Jim Margulis and James Fegan, I'm Josh Nelson. Thanks for listening and watching.